It's time for Live and Local, your connection to local music and more. I'm Kevin Kelly. On the show today, we have Vox Shambana, a small vocal ensemble that dedicates itself to performing and promoting music of the 15th and 16th centuries. They are giving a concert tomorrow night in Champaign at the Chapel of St. John the Divine at 7:30. It's a free program they're calling Vox and Viol, and music focusing on the court of Henry VIII. They're live in our studio, both singers and instrumentalists, and we'll hear from them this hour on Live and Local. Stay tuned. That was music performed by two of my favorite instruments, or families of instruments, shams and sackbuts, by Pífaro, the Renaissance band. From a disc of songs and dances, wind music from Renaissance Italy, which is not the area from which the music that is going to be on tomorrow's Vox Shambana concert comes. I think that sentence made some sense. But I thought that would be a reasonable introduction to what we're going to be talking about this hour. Vox Shambana is a pretty new group. This is, what, your second concert?
That's right.
And that you were here, some of you were here for your first concert, in advance of your first concert. Second concert is tomorrow night in Champaign at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine at Wright and Armory Street. Starts at 7:30, and it's a free program. And it has the title of Vox and Viol, Music for the Court of Henry VIII. John Cox is the leader of the group, organizer of the group. I think we addressed that last time. But you've brought along everybody who's going to be performing on the concert. There are five singers, two male, three female, and also two instrumentalists who've been here before as well. So let's go around and introduce everybody. John, we just heard your voice, and next to you is?
I'm Kelsey Cunningham.
Kelsey Cunningham, and what part are you singing?
I'm a soprano.
Guest soprano, mm-hmm, from the speaking voice.
I'm Helen DeWart, and I'm an alto.
You are an alto?
I'm Sarah Todd, and I'm also singing alto.
Sarah Todd, alto, two altos, and a bass.
Yes, I'm John Wagstaff, and I'm singing bass.
And we have Maureen Murchie on the... What kind of viol have you got there?
Tenor. This is the middle guy.
The middle guy, which looks like a... I don't even know what that looks like. It doesn't look like a viola. It doesn't look like a cello. Well, I guess it sort of looks like a really baby cello. Sort of.
Yeah, it's called a viola da gamba, which means viola of the leg.
Which explains why you're holding it between the legs.
Correct.
And next to you is Ben Hayek, who has a bigger one of those, also viola da gamba. And what voice part does this carry?
This usually doubles the bass, and so usually referred to as the bass viol or bass viola da gamba.
And both have six strings, is that what I'm seeing there?
Correct.
And are these old instruments or replicas of old instruments, or are they just flat out new instruments?
Well, they're... almost as old as we are. They were made in the early 80s, 1980s, but at replicas of English instruments, yeah.
Well, depending on one in the 1980s, they're virtual antiques. Or doesn't that count? I mean, 25 years is an antique in just about anything else in the modern world. I don't think this counts in the old instrument world.
They might get... very valuable after a couple hundred years. Not quite like people. About 25 is our prime, right?
Do people get more valuable as they get older, John?
I have no idea why you're asking me that, Karen, except that I have noticed that I put the average age of the group up by about 15 years, so fair enough. I think basses get better with age, definitely.
You're increasing the value of the group, Jen.
There you go. Yeah, vintage group. Well, speaking of the range of the group, John Cox, you're kind of the guy that put this group together. At least it was your idea, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And where do you get everybody from? I mean, from different places, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's difficult putting together a group of people to perform earlier repertories, specifically Renaissance and medieval repertories, because most vocal training that people get in universities is training for the stage, training for operatic performances, or training to be concert singers where they're performing over an orchestra or with other, you know, it's trying to fill up a large concert hall, opera hall, something like that. Those voices don't necessarily work that well with this music. It's more delicate, and the sound, the overall sound, specifically as you'll hear with the viols, the instruments were not as loud, and so the voices did not need to be that loud to be heard. And so it's a process of going and finding types of voices and also people who are interested in singing earlier repertories. And that's what I set out to do so over the past 6-7 months, was find people who had not only the right voice type, but also the enthusiasm for this style of music.
And so these particular additions, you're in the doctoral program?
Right, I'm in the doctoral program in choral conducting and literature at the school.
This is the University of Illinois.
Right, at the University of Illinois. And Kelsey's also she's an undergraduate there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a sophomore, and I sang in the university chorale with John. So I assume that's how he picked me out.
Well, he must have heard something he liked.
I just got an email one day asking me to be in the group, and I said, sure. So here I am.
Not likely random.
I have been singing in Chamber Singers a couple of years ago, and I still kind of hang around in the in the choir scene.
But so what are you doing? You're not in an academic program, or you are?
No, I'm not, no.
What are you doing?
I work as a staff member at the School of Art and Design.
There you go.
I do a variety of things, but one of the main things I do is teach piano. But I've been a choral singer my whole life. So I have done a lot of singing in this town because this is my hometown. And so...
And how did John find you?
I don't really know.
Well, it's also, you know, the sort of early music world is a little bit cliquish in that when I ask around, who would be the good voice type for this? You know, these are the names that came up a lot. And I sang with Sarah on a DMA recital early in the fall. And sort of inched over closer to her during the rehearsals to be able to hear. and
she just thought you were getting cozy.
Right, right, probably. So.
And John Wagstaff, I know what you do here at the U, which is head the music library.
I do, absolutely, yeah. But I'm also a kind of renter bass, so if anybody needs a bass, they sometimes ask me very kindly. And also maybe the fact that I'm English, you know, John thought I was going to have some extra insight into the life and times of Henry VIII or something.
And do you?
In the genes.
Oh, of course.
Of course, yeah. Well, so he was right. You have insights into all things musical, John.
I try to. Thank you.
Well, why don't we have some music from you all so we know more than academically why we're talking to you. What are we going to hear first?
We're going to start with this courtly love song, Ami Souffre. And it's not uncommon in Henry VIII's court to have French songs. There's a heavy French influence in the Tudor court at this time. And this is for three voices, sort of soprano, tenor, and bass, and that's one of the common textures. Three is more common than four voices in this time period. And as you'll see, the real English stylistic component of this is florid rhythm. There's a lot of running fast notes, as you'll hear.
Vox Shambana here on Live and Local. They're giving a concert tomorrow night in Champaign at 7:30. We'll give you more details a few times during the program. Thank you. So what were we singing about there?
Well, if you've ever taken an undergraduate music history class, you'll learn that these courtly songs are only ever about a couple of subjects. One is love, and that happens to be what we're singing about here. One of the others is war. And the third is life, the pains of life in general. And most of the concert is songs about love, courtly love songs, both the requited and unrequited varieties.
So nothing has changed, in other words.
Yes, you could turn on any pop music station and hear the same three subjects, I guess.
Although war is probably less popular, but protest of some kind or another.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Do the war songs constitute protest songs, or do they glorify the...
The particular collection that this music comes from is entitled Henry VIII's Manuscript, and it's a manuscript of things that came from the court. There are 101 compositions in there. Of those 101 compositions, only three are of a political nature. They're songs, either propaganda songs in favor of an invasion of France sometimes, or a song that celebrates a new monarch, something like that. So of 101, only three are really of this specific political variety. Most of them are love songs.
And did you, just out of curiosity, did you come by the bits of knowledge that you've shared with us so far today and in our previous program because before you got here, is it stuff you're picking up in the doctoral program here? Because I know that the choral program is pretty heavily, in the doctorate anyway, is pretty heavy on the research side of things.
It is. The specific title of the degree program here is Choral Conducting and Literature, which is one of the reasons that I was interested in coming to study here. The University of Illinois' choral conducting program has a history of turning out scholar conductors, that is, people who are more, they're equally as interested in the research and history behind these things as they are the performance of the works. My particular knowledge or interest in this time period really is a product of some classes I took when I was an undergraduate at Oberlin. There was a Collegium Musicum there, and that's when I really started to figure out that I was an Anglophile, that I loved the music from the English Renaissance particularly.
So tell us then more about the theme of this program, and I suspect this is where the other John will come in at some point with his erudition, but it's called Music for the Court or From the Court, mm-hmm. of Henry VIII, who was himself a composer of sorts.
Correct, and a few of the pieces on our program are actually... well, said to be by Henry VIII, whether or not that's true. He of the 101 compositions in his manuscript, 33 are ascribed to Henry VIII. And so it's I think it's pretty clear that he did write many melodies. He was a singer. They have evidence that he wrote songs for his many wives, for them to sing. And so...
And if they didn't sing them well, we know what happened, right?
Yeah, new wife, new soprano.
I think you just reinterpreted the entire Reformation there.
So it was his court in particular of the Tudor monarchs was heavy in arts patronship and of his own interest. So this program is putting together songs of particular interest because of the mixture of English and French. This particular text we just sang, Ami Souffre, is a French love poem, but an English style of composition. One of the other pieces on our program takes two lines from a French chanson and removes the bottom line, and there's a new English bottom bass line put on there. And so it's almost the cosmopolitan environment was facilitating a mixture of these two styles, the French and English at the time. There are also pieces which have English and Latin, or English, French, and Latin.
All in one piece.
All in one piece. So we're not doing any of those. That would be too confusing. No, but we're not going to perform any of those. But there are some really interesting vocal as well as instrumental pieces. We have a few pieces just for the viols, which shows a little bit of experimentation in instrumental composition. At this time, most instrumental music was shadowing or copying vocal music, and that's the way this sort of consort tradition came to be, is that they were transcribing vocal music for just instruments. And then during this time period, the viol consort as a separate ensemble comes to pass. So
the viol consort, and we have two now. Two doesn't really constitute a consort, or does it?
It's almost a consort. Usually, it's three or more. I've seen, although if it's two, it's usually just called a duet. But anywhere from three to six, even some seven part music is usually considered a consort.
And what was in the time of Henry VIII? What would be the most frequent context or contexts for music? Where would it usually be heard? If it was courtly music, just in the court? I mean, was it only court people who got to hear it, or?
Well, it was only court people who got to hear it. This music was written for professionals, for the trained chapel singers, and court jesters, people who were, actors, players who were paid to provide entertainment specifically to the court. And so the answer to that is that yes, by our best guess, this music was only heard by the royal family and their friends at court, the other nobles.
So the royalty kept a group of professionals. Were they essentially servants as they were in Mozart's time, or were they a little more elevated than that?
That's a good question. We don't have a lot of specifics in terms of their lifestyle. We have records of them being paid and a few accounts of what the comings and goings. I would have to say that they were more on the servant side for this reason in specific. When the English kings went to France, Henry V and so on invaded France, and they not only took the court, they took the court musicians to war with them. So, for example, John Dunstable and Lionel Power came in contact with French musicians by simply tagging along with the court as they went and invaded France and set up a sort of ownership of the northern France during that time period. So I'm not sure that would be a very good gig as a musician, to be paid to go with the generals and to everyone into France while the war is going on.
But did they play during the battles?
That's a good question. I don't think they sang during the battles. I think they sang when the battle was over.
Well, I mean, I partly asked that question because we did have a group of players in here from the University of Illinois Sousa Archives, a collection from their collection of over-the-shoulder horns, and apparently they did haul those things into battle and follow along. Or did they lead the soldiers?
They led them,
which would be even a worse gig, you know.
I grew up in bands, and I know that they can be implements of destruction. So, so that
bands.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah, but you probably mean that in a different way.
I do.
Yeah.
I think that this was music for the celebrations, for banquets, for festivals.
And how would this music that we're hearing that's on your program that was heard in the court differ from what the people who aren't in the court would have heard?
I think the themes are the same. The style of composition is much simpler. The folk melodies that we have from England in this time are rarely in three parts. They're generally a one-part song. So the harmonization, or the making a one tune, one melody, and writing a, as we say, a contratenor, a part against the main part, and then writing a superius above that, would have been something that trained musicians were writing. I don't know of many folk songs that are that complex. There are exceptions. There are folk songs from England during this time which are very complex, but they're generally by trained composers, so a professional composer writing for the general public.
And this is a professional composer writing this stuff down so that you're reading off of parts, or is it taught by rote, or what?
They were written down, and these survive in the manuscript and often in fragmentary form in other sources. So they were distributed somewhat widely after the composer's death. So it wasn't as if they were published or sold in that sense. 30, 40 years after the composers have died, and the main composers in this manuscript would be Henry VIII himself, William Cornish and William Cornish Jr., and Edmund Turgis. Those are three somewhat lesser known English composers from the beginning of the 16th century. And their works are disseminated 30, 40 years after their death. You find them in many manuscripts. So they were being copied, but I think that that's sort of after their initial usage at the court.
But it wasn't as if somebody is writing it down after the fact. They wrote it down first.
Right,
and
this
then
is written music.
Just
yes,
like
yes.
We would do now.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've got to bear in mind as well that only at the court and in the churches did they actually have the money to pay scribes to write this music down. And going back to what you were saying earlier about what type of music would people have heard outside court, you've got to bear in mind the kind of occasions on which people would actually have heard music. They would either have heard music by coming to church and hearing it sung, and this would be notated music, or they would have been outside, maybe at some kind of festival or something, so probably that music had a great deal of rhythm, so there was probably percussion, there was probably, say, a flute involved, or some kind of, pipe. That was played, and so, and this is why that music was not written down, because people kind of improvised it in the same way that people improvise music out in the open air these days, I suppose. So you need some kind of rhythm. If people were going to dance outside in some kind of ceremony, then they obviously need a rhythmic section, and they're probably going to have one solo instrument on top, but nobody would bother to notate that kind of music. I mean, even if they wanted to, the person improvising it would not necessarily see the point of writing down a particular version of a tune later on, because the next day they just get up and improvise something else. It strikes me the interesting thing about this type of music that we're performing is it's just a tiny, tiny fraction of what actually of the musical life of 16th century England. We're kind of, looking through a glass darkly at this music. We don't know whether what we've got is totally representative. I mean, from what John is saying about the Henry VIII manuscript, obviously that manuscript was written partly because it contained pieces by Henry VIII, but also because it was considered that this was royal music, therefore it had some kind of specialness. Whether or not it was actually well composed, that's a whole other question. But the fact is it was associated with an important person, and therefore it got written down. And music for the church, which was written for an important institution, also got written down, but music for everyday use did not get written down.
So the music that would be heard in the church, where the public could go and hear this stuff, might be similar to what we're doing here, just with a religious topic instead of love, war, and what was the third thing?
Political.
Politics, yeah.
Politics.
Yeah, that's probably so. And you've got to remember the impact that music in parts, in three or four parts, would have had on people coming in from outside into the church. I think I'm right in saying, though John's the expert on all this stuff, that the general congregation, the people who came into the church, they were not seeing the choir actually performing this music. The choir would perform elsewhere further up the church if it was a large chapel. And so it must have been absolutely amazing to people who were used to either hearing the sounds of nature or to hear occasionally music at festivals, to suddenly hear music in parts. You know, we shouldn't underestimate just how amazing that must have felt to those people.
Well, plus it would would have been just wafting down from a distance away. And
exactly.
As you said, they couldn't even see them probably.
Right. So they're kind of thinking this is the music of the angels, you know, this is kind of heaven coming down to them in some way.
We're talking with members of Vox Shambana, who are giving a concert tomorrow night at 7:30, a free concert at the Chapel of St. John the Divine on Wright and Armory Streets in Champaign. Support for our show today on Live and Local comes in part from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Intercession and summer at Southern include seminars and introductory courses. Southern in summer, sunset concerts, a quiet campus, and hundreds of summer classes. More information is available at siuc.edu. And what do we have next? One of Henry VIII's tunes, I'm guessing.
That's right. This is a four-part composition which has a text that's partly in French and partly in English. We sometimes joke in modern American society about Spanglish. Well, this is a mixture of English and French.
Franglais.
It starts out, Madame d'Amour, all times or hours, from dole dolours, our Lord you guide, in all secours until my powers. So,
Here we go, Vox Shambana on Live and Local. Vox Shambana performing here on Live and Local. If Love Now Reigned, is that the one we just heard?
No, that's
not what we heard.
Madame d'Amour.
Madame d'Amour. And yet, this is one where much of it was in English.
Yes.
Yeah. Henry VIII, the attributed composer here on Live and Local. When, in the court setting where this music was heard, was this Would people sit down and hear concert style, or, you know, this one, Henry and his colleagues are lying around on couches and just eating grapes and somebody's singing this, or is it background music during a party, or what would be a typical setting for the performer?
My guess is that if the king wrote something, everyone's going to listen. And that if most of this music would not have been background music. It was considered entertainment, but it was a subject on which they were to, since this music is somehow a reflection of what courtly life should be, the ideal version of the principles of courtly life, or the main themes of courtly life that the nobility aspire to, I think that this is not background music and more something they would pay attention to, and that there would be, it would be almost a concert setting. That's my opinion. I'm not sure anyone knows for sure.
Does John know for sure? John Wagstaff?
I don't know for sure. I like the idea of people lounging about on couches and eating grapes. I think that was the Roman Empire.
Yeah. But, well, you know, Italy, England, France, you know. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah, they all mix up in the end. No, I think John is absolutely right. And the subject matter of these songs would have been discussed, yes. So people would have thought about the texts of these particular pieces and looked at different aspects of love. We know that people did do this kind of thing. They would sit around in a kind of, not exactly a debating circle, but some kind of informal grouping, and would talk about different aspects of love, or indeed war, or the other things that John has mentioned. Because again, we need to transport ourselves back a little bit to an age where you couldn't just listen to music whenever you wanted, 24/7. And so when music was actually performed, in the same way that if people saw a new picture or a new sculpture, it would be something that was extensively discussed, because it was something that was so new. It wasn't like somebody writing a book today and somebody else writing a book tomorrow and somebody else writing a book next week, and they all get discussed very quickly, if they get discussed at all. This music surely, and as John says, because it was written by the king, yes, surely people listened and wanted to discuss it more, because maybe they wanted to try to work out the king's thoughts on a particular topic, which probably they would then fairly quickly absorb into their own spectrum of opinions.
And maybe, but they just wanted to keep their heads.
Listen or else. Yeah, I don't think all the ladies lost their heads, did they? And I don't think all the six ladies lost their heads. Those are just the ones who are the best known. But
they're the ones whose heads we've heard about. What about the people who didn't listen to his music? We don't hear about them. It's not celebrated.
There could have been many other people buried under the patio. Yeah. We just don't know. No, I agree. But anyway, I mean, to an extent, you could say, if you studied the songs of Henry VIII, you might actually be able to work out, yeah, why he was the guy he was as regarded his thoughts on love, romance, and whatever. Or maybe he had a very conventional idea of what love and romance were like, but he, in his personal life, acted entirely differently. So, there are lots of different ways of looking at this, and they're all pretty interesting.
So the setting likely be the same if it was one of the other pieces not by the king? Or would people have been less likely to listen?
Well, perhaps less likely to listen if a song was written by the hired court composer. But I still don't. This concept of background music, we think about certainly of Haydn, you know, the story of Haydn writing the Surprise Symphony, that getting sick of his music just being there for a party and not being listened to as a work of art or his output. I'm not sure how far back the concept of background music, even if people were still talking, or it wasn't our concept of a concert idea. I think that this was something that was paid attention to. These pieces were to be heard, to be observed, not just there, atmospheric.
But maybe the instrumental music was more background.
It's possible. Yeah. The untexted music is more just for atmosphere.
Yeah. How do you feel about that, Maureen and Ben? You were discriminated against back in the day, in that sense?
You had something to
Well, I was going to say that I think there's also an element of actually music for the sake of the performers. Henry VIII might have performed this himself or played some part in it, and music served as something, you know, for enjoyment. And certainly the nobility had to be trained in music in some respects, whether singing or playing an instrument. So I think they participated as well in some parts of it. So I think music functioned that way as well, not just entertainment for those listening, but for those performing as well.
Mm-hmm. So that comes around to the same semi-facetious question that if the king was playing it, they'd really be better paying more attention than if poor
they
Ben
not
was
yawn
playing.
Or else, yeah. That would be the last time.
Yeah. I'm looking at our time here. It's about 12:45 already. And I know one of you has to leave before too long. And I believe you have another number for us to hear.
We do. This is a very interesting composition called If Love Now Reigned, also by Henry VIII. It's a three-part composition with a very simple middle line. It's thought that this middle line was for a woman to sing, maybe someone who wasn't that good a singer. It's quite simple, lovely composition. And that the two parts around that middle voice are much more complex. They're almost improvisatory writing in the top line. And the bottom line also more active, and it creates a very nice texture of simplicity in the middle with complexity around it. And we're performing this just with the women's voices. So
this way we can't say, you know, it's the woman's part that's the easy one and the guys get the hard one. Is that it?
No, that's not exactly what I meant.
Yeah, okay. Members of Vox Shambana performing here on Live and Local in advance of their concert tomorrow night in Champaign.
Thank you.
Another piece by Henry VIII, If Love Now Reigned, sung by three women from Vox Shambana, Sarah Todd and Ellen DeWart on altos and Kelsey Cunningham soprano. Our other members with us are tenor John Cox and bass John Wagstaff, along with viol players Maureen Murchie and Ben Hayek. And their concert is tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign. It's at the corner of Wright and Armory, and it is a free program. And so, therefore, people just appear and walk in the door and get to hear.
We hope.
Yeah. I'll mention that to support for today's support for today's broadcast, although this is kind of a concert of sorts, is provided by the Friends of WYLL and by Christensen Construction Company in Champaign, building and remodeling homes with a focus on durability. More information about Christensen Construction is available at 217-417-3970. And I'm very grateful to Christensen Construction Company for sponsoring WYLL, but I do have trouble saying those three words in a row for some reason. And I will also mention that at the same location this very night is a concert a little earlier, 6:30, by the three chamber ensembles from the East Central Illinois Youth Orchestra, for which I am responsible. That is the string quartet, the woodwind quintet, and the brass quintet, all from the orchestra, coached by graduate students at the University of Illinois. And it is also free, Chapel of St. John the Divine, tonight at 6:30. And I know they've been working very hard all year. So if anybody out there listening has got nothing else to do tonight and wants to bring your kids along and hear some talented students, it's a good opportunity. I think we have the opportunity maybe to hear an instrumental that will be on the program.
Sure.
As well. I mean, we're mixed. It is called Vox and Viol, voice and viol, not only together, but also a little bit. You're doing sort of a set on your own, right? Or sprinkling
something
some throughout.
Like
something like that. What are we going to hear now?
This is a tenor line from a French chanson by Benchois. It's called Votre très doux regard. Only, so there's a three-voice chanson that exists in French manuscripts. The only thing we find in Henry VIII's book is the middle voice, the tenor, from that chanson, and someone has gone in and written diminutions or a fancy part on top of that tenor. So it's taking one line of a trio and turning it into a duet for instruments.
So in this case, tenor means essentially the melody.
Yes.
The melodic tune.
From tenore to hold the middle line.
And who is, which of you is playing the tenor line?
I am.
That would be
guilty.
Maureen on the tenor viol, and then the bass viol Ben is Ben.
Okay. I was wondering what the title means. Is that, am I going to get you in trouble if I ask?
No, you can.
Okay.
John's our transition
stuff. Oh, we're passing the buck here.
Well, I've been looking at it, you know, all week, wondering. I wonder what I'm supposed to be.
How are you supposed to be interpreting this? Yeah.
Other than, where is my note?
It means your very sweet look, or your very sweet face.
Oh, now how do you interpret that when you're playing the part yourself?
That means it doesn't matter what I sound like. Then. Just gotta look good.
That's right.
On radio.
On radio. Okay. That's right.
Good luck.
Thank you.
this music has endings that sound enigmatic today. You know, it's not just a 1-5-1 and it's over, you know. Mm-hmm. It'd be a totally different life back then, not only just doing what they did, but also listening to this kind of music. It's so much more subdued, at least all of these pieces have been, certainly. I'll mention a couple of other concerts coming up, both of them tomorrow. One is a vocal concert. Opus 24 is giving its spring choral concert at First United Methodist Church in Decatur tomorrow night at 7:30. And on tomorrow's Live and Local, we will have members of the Arcadia Chamber Players on the show, and their concert, I think, is coming up in a week. But I'll have that information for you tomorrow. But they'll be playing some tunes live in our studio as well. I want to say thanks to all the members of Vox Shambana for coming in and playing and singing for us here. It's a treat to hear you. And again, it's John Wagstaff, John Cox, Sarah Todd, Kelsey Cunningham, Ellen DeWard, Ben Hayek, and Maureen Murchie. You can hear them all performing tomorrow night for free at Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign. It starts at 7:30. If they want more information on the group, should they just contact you? If they want to hire you out for weddings or something like that?
Right. Yes, they can send an email to voxshambana, voxshambana, @gmail.com, or johnkcox@gmail.com. Either one of those will work fine.
Whichever you remember better.
That's right.
But you'll remember Vox Shambana very well if you go hear them. Which we're, of course, here to encourage you to do. Go out and see and hear live music. It's why we're called Live and Local, and these guys have been live in our studio on the show today. I'm Kevin Kelly. We have Forecast for you coming up in just a few minutes. And then Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac is at a minute past 1 o'clock, and classical music for you at 1:06. We have additional support for our program today from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. Going out with some music by William Boyce from England, but of a slightly later time period, this is a short symphony of his on Live and Local.